Hello there and welcome to the show. Big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Tuesday, September 16th, and you are listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh.
So it's sport for the next hour until the new music show comes on at 7pm. We'll have Katie Kirk, who has the latest in the World Athletics Championships. Mark Langdon sets us up for the opening night of the new Champions League season. And Conor Murray joins us for a detailed chat on the highs and lows of his life in rugby.
As always, if you want to get in touch, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 0871879200, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Yes, hello there. Good evening. You're welcome along to the show. Mark Langdon will be joining myself and Ruby very shortly to chat Champions League nil-all in Bilbao between Athletic Club and Arsenal after 22 minutes. And in the Netherlands, Union Saint-Gilloise lead PSV Eindhoven by a goal to nil. 23 minutes gone in that one. But first, we are turning our attention to athletics. Katie Kirk is with us. And Katie, let us begin by speaking about Sarah Healy, who finished 10th in the women's 1500 metres final at the World Athletics Championships in Tokyo. Healy's time was just under 2 seconds outside her own national record. It's been a long but positive road this year with plenty of signs of progression.
Yeah, I mean, Sarah, of course, winning her first European Championship medal, which was in those European indoors, which were in March. And I think that that has really given her a platform and a trajectory this season that you can understand why she's a little bit disappointed, I would say, coming in off the back of winning that in the indoor season. Maybe she had higher hopes. But I do think that looking at the stats at the start where she was ranked, I think she was ranked roughly 9th overall based on personal best. It really is a decent performance. But I think from listening to her interview after, I think she definitely wanted more for herself and felt she maybe didn't get all of that out of herself on the day. But I also think, you know, she did finish 6th as well at those World Indoors in the indoor season. And I'm sure she wanted a little bit more, but I think it was a really decent performance given that she initially did not qualify for the final. That was due to a disqualification of the Italian athlete. So maybe it was a little bit harder to pick yourself up from that, but definitely a performance to be proud of and hopefully lots of exciting things to come for Sarah Healy.
Okay, well, she was speaking to Darren Frehill after the final this afternoon.
Honestly, it was probably like the exact kind of race I was hoping for, and I think I raced really well for like 80%. I just didn't have it in the last 200 today. I just felt like tired. So that's, you know, disappointing, but I think I executed a great race up until that stage and then just, didn't have the legs, which is a shame because, I felt that race would probably really suited me if I, you know, if I felt like 100% amazing. I just didn't have it at the end.
Remind you, in 2019, Ciara McGeehan was the same position as you were right now and a similar stage in your career. Like, you must take a lot from that.
Yeah, 100%. Obviously, Ciara has been so inspiring for me and still is. And I remember watching her in 2019. I was huge. And in Budapest, especially, I was at that championship and it was so cool seeing her do so well. It's definitely, I know I can hopefully make similar improvements as well, yeah.
And I know you're a little bit upset with this, but what a year. And it's been a long year, hasn't it?
Yeah, like honestly, I'm not even that upset. I'm just probably just a bit emotional. It's been a crazy year. And when I look back, I'll be so proud.
And as corrected by Katie Kirk, that's why we pay you the big bucks, Katie. I did say that Sarah Healy holds the national record. It is, of course, Ciara McGeehan, but massive credit to Sarah Healy, 10th in the world.
And she was self-critical today, Katie. She said after the race, I feel a bit helpless at the end of the race. And then she said, I have my own theories why that happened. Do we have any idea? Like, she's not telling us, and I'm assuming you're only guessing too, but do we have any idea what she's talking about?
One of the things that I think for me has been a little bit of a theme running through these championships, from Rashida not participating because of her injuries, Jakob Ingebrigtsen not qualifying from the heats because, you know, he's been carrying a really challenging Achilles injury. I'm not saying that Sarah's been carrying an injury, but the majority of athletes that are going to be competing in these world championships often they are dealing with much more than people realise, especially in terms of the health of their bodies, maybe the health of their minds. And I think that for Sarah, for example, it's very hard to come away from a very long season like this and not have something that might be bothering you in terms of injury, injury troubles. And that could have potentially hampered some build up in terms of her training, so that maybe she wasn't feeling completely fine tuned. I mean, I really don't have any idea on that. But I think that from seeing that, and I think that part of the reason for that as well is the length of the season and the decision made by World Athletics to continually extend the length of the athletic season. It's putting massive pressure on athletes' bodies. And obviously that, you know, Sarah isn't telling us those reasons. I'm not sure if that's why, but I do think that, you know, we do have the potential to see more athletes that might be struggling with injury at the end of the year.
Okay, elsewhere, Keane McPhillips and Mark English both qualified for the semi-finals of men's 800 metres. Now, Mark English has a humdinger of a semi-final draw. He's alongside a reigning Olympic champion, a reigning world champion, the Olympic bronze medalist and the 2023 world medalist as well. I want to ask you about Keane McPhillips, Katie, because probably not a household name to the casual athletics fans, but what a talent.
Oh my goodness, Keane McPhillips won his heat. Oh my goodness, I'm not sure I would have predicted that. I'm sorry if Keane's family are listening, they'll be thinking, of course he was going to win his heat. But coming into this, and I think looking at his heat yesterday, I think he was ranked about seventh within that. So to come and really dominate, and I think when you were watching the race, you were thinking, okay, now's the time where maybe he's going to move backwards, but he just kept powering on, really held his form in those last 20 metres so, so well. And I think that his strength has really shown. And Shane, he's another athlete who has been dealing with some injury challenges this year. He fell at the European Indoors, was reinstated to the semi-final and dealt with some injury issues after that. And he's someone else who has come back to these championships off the back of an injury and is performing the best he ever has in his life.
Okay. And finally, after an injury-interrupted season, Charlene Maudsley cut little ice in the third of the three semi-finals of the 400 metres, flagging late on to finish 8 in 51.22. Will this be seen as a stepping stone? It's not where she wants to be, but we have to be realistic. It is where she is at the moment.
I mean, I think it's a really good performance. I think her semi, sometimes you find for some athletes, if they're coming into this, as we know Charlene has, and I feel like we're just mentioning injuries constantly, but...
No, but unfortunately,
that's the reality. Yeah. Coming into this, you know, carrying an injury from that indoor season and obviously dealing with the death of her father this year, it really hasn't been an easy time for her, and she is a very resilient person. But I do think coming off the back of that semi-final and the high of that, it can be very difficult to get yourself going again, but she has proved time and time again that she is fantastic at competing in these championships. She does all of the relay, she does the individual 400, and it is a fantastic platform for her. It's, I think, her first global semi-final outdoors, and I'm sure she will be absolutely delighted when she looks back. But I'm sure it's a little bit of a bitter pill to swallow, but I think given everything she's had this year, I think it was a decent performance.
Okay, brilliant stuff. Katie Kirk, thank you so much for detailing all of that. Just to mention as well, David Kenny has been forced to withdraw from Saturday's men's 20k race walk due to recent illness, and we wish Andrew Coskren all the best in the final of the 1500 metres tomorrow. Marie will have all the details of that, but for now, Katie Kirk, thanks so much.
Game on. Association football.
We are turning our attention to the Champions League. It is the opening night of the new Champions League. 36 teams set to take part. Mark Langdon joins us on the line. Arsenal are the early ones in action against Athletic Bilbao. Still nil all in that game. 36 teams, Mark. Still a good competition, isn't it?
I really like it, Ruby. I think the format worked for the better. I don't think it's perfect. I think it's hard to get a perfect competition now, given the kind of the wealth that is right at the top of the game, and that's not changing anytime soon with some real dominant leagues, and you know, you will get the haves and the have-nots, and you will get mismatches, but definitely were fewer mismatches in last season's format. I know that sort of 36 teams in one league is not the most pleasing on the eye. And it does mean that a lot of teams will make it through to the next phase. But I think every sort of match week, you're guaranteed now, you know, some great games. And over the next few nights, we've definitely, you know, got that Liverpool, Atletico Madrid, Bayern against Chelsea, Newcastle against Barcelona. So, you know, there's really big games, and that wasn't happening enough in the old format. So I think the new format worked reasonably well last year. And so, yeah, I'm sort of more than sort of happy we've given it at least another kind of, you know, few years to bed in.
Well, myself and Shane both enjoyed reading your take on the 36 teams in the Racing Post. You went for Barcelona as number one. We both were wondering how you managed to get Newcastle at 9, but I did think at 15 you were giving Juventus a lively outsider's chance.
Yeah, so Newcastle, I actually think Newcastle are, in terms of dark horses, are definitely a team to watch out for in this competition. You know, Isak's loss was a big one. You can't get away from that. But their midfield, Tonali, Guimaraes and Joe Linton, is really strong. And then I look at the quality. Voltimada, of course, scored on his debut at the weekend against Wolves. Anthony Gordon hasn't really been playing that much this season due to his red card. Get him and Elanga either side of Voltimade, and I think you've got a dangerous front three. I don't think they are going to go on and win it, but the Premier League, we spoke about it a couple of weeks ago, just a strength in depth for the Premier League. If you're a top team in the Premier League, that just, you know, organically makes you, you know, somebody that can compete at the highest level in the Champions League, even if you're not Liverpool, you know, Arsenal or Manchester City. Juventus have started this season really well. So in terms of dark horses, I mean, you know, it's not what you do in September, it's what you do, you know, after Christmas. But they definitely look improved, you know, this season from last year. Bremer, the centre-back, is back from injury. They're using a few more younger players up front. I think Jonathan David is a real quality free transfer addition. And, you know, that they won an absolute classic at the weekend. They beat Inter 4-3. And I think there's sort of a changing of the guard in Italy. Even though Inter didn't win it last year, they were still seen, I think, by many as the best sort of, you know, team in Italy in terms of competing for the Champions League. And of course, they reached the final. But I think that final sort of broke their hearts, really. And they don't look the same team this time around. So if there is to be an Italian threat, I think it might come more from Juventus than Napoli, because Antonio Conte's record in this competition absolutely stinks, given the amount of quality he's sort of worked with previously. More than a decade now, or around about a decade, since he last won a Champions League knockout stage match, which you know, goes to show how bad he's been. And you mentioned it there. I put Barcelona as number one. I thought they were unlucky last year. So many good young players. And, you know, Lamine Yamal, he stamped his authority on the competition last season, but it wasn't enough to get Barcelona the win. He's getting better. Pedri, Gavi, you know, young players that have got that scope to improve. That's why I went for Barcelona to win it.
Elsewhere this evening, Mark, Spurs at home to Villarreal. How will Thomas Frank's Spurs shape up this evening and indeed in the coming months in Europe?
Well, I think it's hard to say how they'll shape up, because they've been sort of inconsistent, really. They were dreadful against Bournemouth a couple of weeks ago, and then, you know, either side of that have beaten Manchester City and also West Ham very convincingly. So I think you get that sometimes with a new manager, don't you? Like, there is that inconsistency to performance. I still wonder about the depth in midfield and at the back for them to, you know, to really be able.
We seem to have lost Mark Langdon.
I think probably finishing somewhere between 9th and 24th is probably in the... Hello?
We have you, Mark. Work away. Unfortunately, we don't. But that is where we are ending our conversation this evening. Anyway, on football, Spurs against Villarreal this evening, 8 o'clock. Real Madrid against Marseille. Xabi Alonso against Roberto De Zerbi. Juve against Dortmund, as Mark mentioned. And Benfica against Carabag as well. Paul Curry will be discussing all of that on tomorrow's show as well.
I love Mark's little line in the Racing Post this morning. Bodo glimpsed in the Arctic Circle. Man City are there in January. And I did have a look thinking, where exactly are they? They're the very north of Norway. I did think it was a really good read if you want a 1-36 of the Champions League.
Yeah, no, definitely. You can hear, or you can read more of Mark's works on the race. But we have the Arctic Circle, we have Cara del Mate out east, we have a grand geographical spread in...
Cypriot champions, Azerbaijan, they're all in there.
Yes, Carabag, of course, who defeated Shelburne on the way, Ruby, to making the league stage. Just to update you on the ongoing matches, 35 minutes played, Bilbao, Athletic Club 0, Arsenal 0, PSV Eindhoven 0, Union Saint-Gilloise 1. We are taking a short ad break. Never turn your attention to rugby because we have Conor Murray. A very detailed chat. Ruby speaks to Conor Murray. It is not to be missed. Stick with us here on Game On 2FM.
This is 2FM Game On Rugby.
Welcome back to Tuesday's Game On, but right now we're taking you back to Friday here in studio when Conor Murray joined me before his late, late show appearance to discuss his new book, Cloud Nine, and his decision to announce his retirement from professional rugby that very afternoon.
Game On Rugby.
Conor, how does recently retired sound?
It's only a couple of hours old that I've fully announced it, I suppose, but it feels great. Yeah, it was a... you know, you kind of felt it coming, I suppose. So, like, to finally be able to say it
you
clearly.
Felt, you more than felt it coming.
I felt it
just
coming.
Just doesn't
for a
dawn
long time.
On you
yeah,
right, like.
Yeah, look, I was keeping it open-ended to see if anything came across the table to suit
when you say
family.
To suit, that obviously means abroad.
Abroad and
France,
somewhere nice
England.
To live. Yeah, maybe not England, but somewhere sunny and France or Japan or Australia. And there was a couple came.
Yeah.
And... they just didn't suit. Yeah, like I think I've filled my boots. I've kind of squeezed everything out of myself. I think I know, in Ireland, in Munster, in Ireland, and it would only have been really for my family to bring them abroad and live somewhere sunny for a short period of time.
Do you think Alfie would have known where he was?
I know exactly. Yeah, more Joanna was driving this bus now than me. So, I feel really content to say I'm done now.
Content.
Yeah.
Anyway, relieved or just content?
Content and relieved. You're like, I suppose, like you probably know yourself, like it was getting to the point where it was nearly
work.
A bit of a drag. Yeah, yeah, a bit of a chore. But I remember, I think Andy Farrell said it, like you need to go before, not to me, but like he said it to a group, you need to go before it becomes a chore because people will see through it then. So I think I just about got out before it became tough.
Are you more than just got out? I
mean, yeah.
If you look back at your record, 134 caps was it? I've notes written everywhere here for Ireland, 15 years on the senior ranks with Munster. Like, that's a long career.
Yeah.
You must have looked after yourself incredibly well.
I did, thankfully, yeah, yeah. And it was long, but... you know, and I suppose people say like it goes really quickly. No, not that it dragged, but I enjoyed it all. It felt really real. It felt like 15 years of great times, ups and downs. And like I've loads of mates, not loads, but lads who retired through injury or didn't get a contract renewed. And, you know, I feel very, I suppose, fortunate. I got to call it on my own terms with me, Pete and Cian with Ireland over in Rome and then down in South Africa with Munster, albeit we lost, but you can't have the perfect.
Can't get every high.
Yeah, you know what I mean. So we had plenty of highs, thank God.
Plenty of highs. I'm sure there could have been a low or two too. If you were to pick one low moment first, what would you say? Jeez, I wish that hadn't happened. Career wise,
yeah. I wish it didn't happen. There was a low moment really early in my career against Racing where I tried to dummy a kick, I got caught.
You're showing off that day, no?
No, I was just too tired to kick it out.
I did read it in the book.
It was a mud bat.
It was a wet day, mud bat.
Yeah, yeah. So that was what I'm glad happened.
But that's a mistake now. That's not a low moment. That's a mistake.
Yeah.
And surely, I always felt, and maybe you don't, but mistakes make you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, I felt low after the mistake, but definitely made me. I'm glad I went through it. I understood the kind of ramifications of... not doing the right thing. Good learning curve. I was 22 or so. But low was the feeling after the 2023 quarterfinal against New Zealand, the loss.
There's no repairing that.
No repair. That's a scar that will be there forever, I suppose. And just because, I was trying to describe it before, we don't pay attention to like world rankings, but we in 2019 we went to the World Cup and we kind of had just reached number one in the world. We're aware of it, people tell you about it, but we don't talk about it. In 2023 we went there and we were aware, there was no avoiding it, we were world number one for a long time, for I don't know, maybe over a year. We had beaten the All Blacks, we had gone to New Zealand and won a series, we'd done it, I suppose we kind of done it all, so we legitimately had a reason to think we could do well at the World Cup. And I know you have to win it on the day, and we didn't manage to do it against New Zealand. So like just we weren't ready to leave France at that stage. We were having such a good time in the Stade de France every weekend. You know, the zombie song, the Fields of Athenry, the whatever, songs the Mad Irish were singing, and then it just ended so abruptly, and it was such a good opportunity that unfortunately.
Unexpected?
Yeah.
That hurts.
Yeah. We spoke about it in the debrief over the next few days with the players, with a few beers on board, and we were all just like, we weren't expecting it. And I suppose that's weird saying it as an Irish rugby or sports.
Though.
Yeah, we
which
weren't.
Was the, so which was the brilliance of it. Yeah. You went there as favourites and you were carrying that mantle.
And we were doing well with it up until, I think we always look back at that game at the start of it. We just started so slowly. And we were starting so well in games leading up to that. And we the All Blacks just got a 19-0 lead or something. I'm not sure if that's exactly correct. And then we clawed our way back to within, like, I have a moment, I give away a penalty, Jordy Barrett kicks it, we get back in the game. You know, poor Ronan Keller gets held up, and like 9 out of 10 times he'll get that down. Like, talking about my book, I suppose I was thinking of nearly taking the ball off Ronan and going down the blind side, and it was just Aaron Smith there, who's I'm probably bigger physically than him. So all kinds of ifs, buts and maybes, and that's sport, I suppose, and that's the way it goes, isn't it?
But the flip side of that is, if I gave you an opportunity to live one moment again, what would you take?
I'd live Chicago 2016 again. There was an argument there for 2018 away to England to win the Grand Slam. That was up there too. But Chicago was just the dream week, really. It was such a novelty of going to the States, playing the All Blacks. You know, the serious and the sad side was Anthony Foley stuff before that, you know, the Glasgow week. And then we went and we did the figure of eight, and which was beautiful. And but just that week, that game, you know, I was in flow that game. I've accessed it a few times. I don't know how to access it, obviously. You would have done it every time, but things felt easy that day. It felt not, because it was such a novelty of being in Chicago playing those boys, it didn't feel pressure, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember how I was rooming with Zeebo that week, and
so that was always
he's a tonic. Like, he can just make you feel like the best player in the world, and he was like, we're going to rip it up today and blah blah blah, and you're going to throw me the ball, and we actually ended up doing all of those things that we said we'd do. So
was he a visualiser then?
A dreamer and an ultra positive guy, and just a joy to be here. Like, I remember before that game, I'd usually get to the ground, go to the dressing room, music in the ears, serious enough, laid back, but, you know, getting my head in the game. Whereas Eves would go out and walk around the pitch and hopefully, you know, get a few selfies and the usual. And on that day, he was like, come on, Murray, we'll go out and we'll do a lap or whatever. And we walked out, and it was November in Chicago, but it was blue skies, nearly warm. It was a beautiful day. And he was like, man, where would you rather be? Like, we're living the dream here. And I was like, you know what? This is class. We are. And then we had a great day.
Away you go. I was in the Aviva when you came back that November to beat them. And it was my favourite rugby moment.
Yeah.
You played with incredible people, some great players. You played inside Rod. You played inside Johnny Sexton. You played on Lions tours with various out halves. You roomed with Mike Phillips.
Mm.
A hero of yours.
Yeah.
Did you appreciate all the different people you played with? Guys that were older than Mitch, the friends you've made.
Yeah.
How, that's almost like a childhood dream, I mean.
It is, yeah. I do. I really, as you come to the end as well, you think back on all those memories, and I really, really appreciate the opportunities that it kind of afforded me, the people I got to meet along the way. And Mike Phillips, yeah, hero. Like, probably the first tall scrum half I started looking up to, you know, because I'm awkward for a scrum half, or just taller, tall. And whereas lads are usually like 5'6", 7'8" or whatever. And he paved the way. He did. He really, really did. And he was, as he says himself, he was world class at it. and yeah, and then I remember 2013 going to Carlton House for our pre-Lions camp, our pre-flying to Australia camp, and walked into the room, looked on the ground, and the Lions, my roommate's bag said Phillips on them, and I was like, oh my God, this is nerve-wracking. Like, as in, what am I going to say to this fella? Like,
what kind of a character was he?
Legend. Such a nice guy. Like, back of the bus, like, abusing lads, sitting with Paul O'Connell, slagging lads, and just holding court, and that's where the hierarchy were. And he was calling me a poor man's Mike Phillips for the whole tour, and I remember him slagging Owen Farrell, like, that he was only there because his dad was the coach, and just dishing out slags, and then we forged a friendship over that tour, to the point where, like, we're still in touch today. He lives out in Dubai, and try and see him anytime we're out there. So like people like that you looked up to, and now you're kind of friends.
Who was the best player you played with?
Not because he wrote the forward, but Johnny. Like you said, I had a front row seat of seeing him in action, and Rog, and obviously I only played
2 years at Rog?
And learned an awful lot really quickly with him. But then I played the majority of my career with Johnny, and he made me better quicker. Like, the standards he expected, like, straight away made me kind of clue in a little bit quicker. But just the view, the front row seat I had of seeing how he operated, how he saw space, how he commanded respect, and demanded people to be in the right areas for him to make the team work, was just different level. And, like, you'd see lads in camp on the computers all, like, hours doing computer work, and you'd never really see Johnny on it. Now, he did do computer work, but his IQ was so high. So
you only need to see it once.
Only need to see it once, and would remember moments from games when he's talking in meetings and things. Just ultra impressive, and yeah, he'd be the number one.
Who did you dislike most playing against? I won't say dislike most. I wouldn't ask you that kind of a personal question. But anyone you didn't like playing against, you thought he's awkward. He's just can't be. Yeah, no, not looking forward to
that. Dave Toner. Straight away, yeah, the length of him, sure, like. Yeah. I'd be kicking from the base of the ruck, like, and he would just always be there, and, like, it's hard enough hitting it over tall enough, and he's, like, so tall. So him, Dave was all, even, like, yeah, the forwards in Ireland would say it, like, he'd be injuring his own players, like, stepping on lads' toes when he didn't mean to, and just, like, elbows and edges, and just, who said he was, it was like tackling a coffee table standing upright, it was like tackling Dave. So he was just an awkward fella to play against. And Kieran Reid was just a tough player with New Zealand, just one of these, like,
hardcore,
old school, well, slick as well, so talented, so skillful, but just like the real deal.
As such, you had three jobs. Most of which are bread and butter, Ireland, and you were on three Lions tours.
Mm.
So if we start with the Lions, it was, I suppose, I read it, it is the ultimate accolade for any rugby player in this part of the world. Three different tours, three different countries. Is it all it's cracked up to be?
Yes, 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 and more, I suppose. Yeah, I've experienced three of them. 21 was COVID hit, and that was a strange one. It was a tour, but it kind of wasn't. The fans make up a big part of that. Australia was amazing in 2013. It was just an eye opener. It was all this new experiences for me. I was 24, and, like, everything happening was just like, no way. Like, room with Mike Phillips, and just the way it, like, you play with your club, you get looked after really well, then you go to Ireland and you get looked after a little bit better just because maybe budgets or whatever, and then you go to Lions and it's just another animal, another beast. Like, like, you've security guards going everywhere with you, and you've just all the best of everything. And, like, I grew up not even thinking of Lions. Like, I remember, but loving watching it. I remember the tour in 2000, the previous one in Australia was 2001, and I remember the jersey, the NTL jersey, the Lions jersey, and begging. We were down in Kerry, where we'd spend our summers in Derrynane, and I was begging my dad to bring one down so I could wear it on the beach playing tip rugby, and I wore it all summer long. And we'd watch the games early in the morning in the local bar down there. Your mum would open it up for us.
Freddy's,
there you are. Oh, yeah, nice. Yeah, a little down the steps there to the TV room, and all of a sudden, like, you fast forward to 13, and you're. I remember we had to do the photo shoot for the jerseys, in the Six Nations camp. They'll send the Lions jerseys over because on the day you'll be announced. Yeah. And I remember going back to my room to change into it, and, like, putting it on the bed and being like, "This is just a pinch me moment." I wasn't selected at the time, but I was like, "This would be really, really cool." And then fast forward to our first game, against the Barbarians in Hong Kong, looking at the jersey. It was me and Johnny were on the bench. I remember just, like, staring at the jersey hanging up with my name. They embroidered your name and stuff. It's really cool. And looking at it going, I'm going to wear this later, and I'm going to become become a lion. So it is, it's really, really special. And I was jealous of watching the boys this summer do the same thing.
But you had great success with the Lions as well. Obviously, you won with Australia, you drew the test with New Zealand, and you ended up losing South Africa. So like that was the ultimate, which was the Lions. Then you had Ireland, which is a huge accolade as well. So you played under three different coaches.
Yeah.
Declan, Andy, and Joe in the middle.
Yeah.
How different were they?
Three very different humans, yeah. Three coaches who've won Grand Slams, which proves there's many ways to coach a team. Decky was brilliant. Decky was the guy who gave me my first shot, took a chance on me, I suppose. I was a bit of a bolter in 2011 and I suppose snuck into the squad, and he mentored me quite a bit. My first few years with Ireland, again, kind of like the Lions, I was just enjoying it, taking in all these new experiences. And
which when you're young, you know.
Only young and you don't know.
Fear. You're not afraid of getting something wrong. You don't know what's going to go wrong.
I remember Dunners O'Callaghan, and I said it to him the other day, he doesn't remember saying this, but young lads don't know the consequences of, you went out and made a mistake when I was 21. I was like, oh, whatever, it's fine. And then you do it and you're 34 or 5. You're like, the consequence of me doing that, like literally like the penalty I gave away against the All Blacks, like, you're aware. So, Decky was just he was a teacher, so he would be just looking after you away from rugby as much as he was on the pitch, and learned a lot from him. He caught me booking a holiday to Thailand on the night before we played the All Blacks, and just kind of quietly said it to me after we lost 60-0 the next day, being like, maybe just arrange your stuff a little bit better, and just trying to make you a better person, I suppose.
Should organise you.
Yeah, just look after you a bit.
What about Joe then? Much more demanding, much more clinical?
Yeah, exactly. Probably what you've heard in terms of just very detailed. Again, an ex-teacher, I'm sure. Yeah, he was. And just really detailed, really straight to the point, like what he needs from you. Very systematic.
Would he lecture you?
Quite strict. Lecture you.
Bollock you.
Yeah. Now, I can speak, there's lads I know who weren't selected under Joe, but were in camps, probably had a much tougher time. Whereas with me and a few other boys who we did start under Joe for his tenure, probably got away with a little bit more. You know, not misbehaving, but just like if you dropped the ball or you threw a bad pass, he probably wouldn't say as much as he would to a fella.
Or was your skin a bit thicker? You'd been there longer.
No, I remember because one of my good mates, I won't name him, but he was on the fringes, and he'd be showing me stuff, clips and stuff about like someone in his position who was starting and not getting bollocked out of it, and then him doing the same thing and him getting a serve. So and also maybe a bit thicker skin, that I knew I was around a little bit longer. But we had, like, we'll talk about Andy obviously, but like Joe, we had such success under Joe. We two Six Nations wins, a Grand Slam, beat the All Black, like did quite a bit. And then people, say it kind of faded out, or the game plan didn't work in 2019 World Cup. And to a point, that's fair. But then I remember that 2019 World Cup where we just played poorly. You know what I mean?
Japan.
And we just didn't.
Shocking.
We did, I know, brutal. And then put ourselves in the back foot massively. And my gripe with that is we didn't execute Joe's plan in that World Cup. You know what I mean? We just played poorly. We were dropping balls. We were throwing passes on the ground, and we didn't get to see how far that game plan would take us. Now, Andy definitely evolved it.
Yeah.
To probably where it needed to go. But that's one point I would always argue. We didn't play well in that. We just didn't play well as players. That wasn't
Which
Joe's fault.
You're human too.
Yeah. So it's unfair to judge Joe's game plan on us being poor.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And then you say Andy evolved it. But what else? What new? That's not the right word. What new things did he bring to the table?
Yeah, no, he did. He rugby wise, he brought phase play, basically. So just like, I suppose under Joe, we'd have three phase moves. And, if we didn't unlock a defence in those three phases, we'd probably have to get rid of the ball or kick it or find another way. Whereas Andy was big on holding onto the ball and for as many phases as we wanted to, and playing to space a little bit more, and still had our phase play moves, or our line outs and strike plays, if you know what I mean. And then he just evolved us as rugby players, really, just heads up. And
would Andy have allowed you play more off instinct
free control? Yeah, a little bit freer. Yeah. definitely. And he'd back you to, he'd back you to go, I suppose, where the space is, where you think you can get most reward. And that's the rugby. That's probably the main, like loads of other stuff, but that's the main rugby thing. But the environment in general just became a little bit more relaxed, you know. Joe's environments were stressful, were intense, and that's the way he wanted it. And yeah, like I said, we got success out of it. But Andy's way of coaching, or you know, the way he sees the world, is just let lads relax, be themselves, and when we're on, we're on. Like, he made it, and Joe didn't have this available to him. We have our training centre in Abbottstown, and then we have Carton House where we stay. Yeah. And he made Carton House like a non-rugby place, so we'd go to the training centre, do our
work,
intense stuff, work for from 8 till 3 maybe, back to Carton House. Now, you had your laptops with your rugby on it, but other than that, there was no meetings, there was no, there was pool tables, the sport was on in the evenings, you know, relaxed. So just different ways,
made it more homely.
Yeah and then that probably encouraged lads to be around the team room a little bit more, and you know, and be
not always being watched, not always
hiding in your room afraid of a meeting happening. Or Joe, like, lads would be, he used to wreck. Jamie Heaslip said, like, Joe would have a meeting at 9 o'clock, but lads would be so feared about being late, they'd genuinely be sitting down at 8:45, and we're like, lads, we're still like 15 full minutes here, but lads were just too, so that was just the way it was. But like, I will always argue or tell you, we had a great time with Joe. We did. We had great times.
Made some players out of y'all, there's no doubt about that. Then we look at Munster, 15 years, numerous coaches. Was there ever a point in Munster you thought, maybe I'd like to go somewhere else? Or were you just red to the core?
I grew up wanting to play at Munster. Like, that was my first jersey I dreamed of putting on. I used to go to Thomond Park when I was 10 or 11 and 2 hours early so I could get to stand by the tunnel to see my heroes walk out, like, and that was my dream. And I suppose I came into the Munster team when they were just fresh enough off winning European Cups in 2006 and 8. I came in around 10-11, won a Magners League and just expected it,
the ball to keep rolling.
Yeah, and it's hard probably not to make this sound arrogant, but I was like, I wonder when I'm going to win my European Cup, because it was just, they were a force, like, and I promise you it's not cocky, but it was just, surely this is
going to happen.
And then it was me, Pete, Earlsey, Zeebs, more lads that kind of took the reins, I suppose, after a couple of years of that, maybe 13 when Rog went, and for it to not happen, it's Pete said it, and I've heard him say it in an interview, so it's out there. Like, he would consider his Munster career a failure, and that's probably a dark way of saying it, but just overall, not to, because the Holy Grail for us was the European Cup.
Yeah.
Now, we managed to win the URC, which was...
Twice, didn't you?
Yeah, we won in when it was the Magners League in 11, then 23. Mm. That meant a lot to all of us, kind of older lads, Stephen Archer, Pete, me, Earlsey. These type of lads, because it was just a bit of a weight off our shoulders that we got our own bit of silverware. So there was always a love and a drive to do well with Munster. Your head would be turned at certain stages, but the fact, you've probably heard it before, like, we're so well looked after in Ireland, especially if you're playing with the national team, your body is looked after really well, your game time is managed. And I suppose I was so lucky with Ireland from when Joe came in, we were successful nearly immediately, and we were successful right until I left. So that was always a carrot that I wouldn't leave, because I don't know if there's a written rule, or if it's just
unless you're Johnny Sexton, there is.
Yeah, unless it's a Johnny Sexton rule and you can go to Paris and play and still get picked. But that was a risk I wasn't willing to take. I've obviously loved Munster and I loved playing with Ireland naturally, so it was good to me.
In your book, and I was reading it in the papers the last couple of days too, didn't have a great relationship with Graham Rowntree, and that not everybody gets on with everybody.
Yeah.
But is the lack of success just down to poor coaching, or is it more than that?
Yeah, like, the reason, not the full reason I want to do a book, or I said yes to doing it, because you don't have to do it, you know what I mean? And I wanted to make sure if I did do it, I was honest in it, and I suppose I said it as it is, or how I felt at the time. And yeah, me and Graham didn't really have, like, we were cordial definitely, but just there was times where I didn't feel respected towards the end, and it's very hard not to sound kind of bitter about it, but you know what I mean? I get changing of the guard. Like, I know that that happens, and I still trained as hard as I could to be selected, but it wasn't about that. It was about, you know, like, I was getting 5-6 minutes sometimes off the bench, and you're like, while still being second choice with Ireland, and I'm kind of like, this doesn't make sense. So my mind, he had made up his mind about who was his number one, and there was times where me and Keith Earls dropped out of the 23 completely against Toulouse at home in Europe. Now, I had been injured, but I got injured making my 100 cap at Ireland 2 weeks previous, so it wasn't a long term injury, and came back, named the 23, and I went up to him after the train, and I was like, what's going on? And he's just, you don't deserve it. And I was kind of like,
don't deserve it.
I've never really clashed with coaches or like done anything bad here. What you mean? And that was all I got. You know what I mean? That's as far as the conversation went. And yeah, I just felt disrespected, and I had to say it because it's how I felt.
In your opinion, what will it take to get Munster back to winning Heineken Cups?
There's the ability's there, and I genuinely mean this. I think the player ability's there. From what I've heard, the new coach, Clayton McMillan, is doing a great job. It's obviously really early days, but the boys seem to be in good spirits. Signings, you do need to make, you know, I know Leinster didn't get over the line in Europe last year, but the fact that they brought in big hitters like Orji and Jordy Barrett is something you need to look at. And I have a point in the book, and I'm glad a couple of players I spoke to before I put it out kind of agreed with me, or did agree with me, that in terms of Munster signings over the years, that there's some of them that you'd be scratching your head being like, why weren't we consulted on the senior players now? As soon as you became established, I suppose we would have liked to have been consulted about some signings, just because we would know someone who could tell us about this particular
person individual.
Whether they're ability wise they're good enough, or like personality wise they'll fit into what we're about in our culture. And now, we did make some unreal signings, and you know, over the years, but there was somewhere we were just like, who's making the final call on this, lads? Like, because we're in the game here now, we would be able to offer our opinion or make one phone call and, you know, make it a bit easier. So yeah, just maybe involve some senior players or ex-players to get on board with the recruitment side of things. But I get finances and things like that. But there were times where we'd sign a fella, probably wasn't up to the standard, and we knew he was on fairly decent money. So, you know, you can't throw the finance excuse at us that way. But yeah. And
you think the scope is there? You think
I do.
A few things refined, certain things done a bit better, a bit cleverer.
Yeah,
Munster can be competitive.
Yeah, and like I get it with Leinster and the conveyor belt they have up here of, you know, the school system and just the sheer volume of players, you're probably going to end up with more quality players in the long run, just numbers wise. It's just a numbers game. But I think, you know, with a few things like that, Munster can. And I said it last night in Thomond Park, just to reiterated that this comes from a place of loving Munster. This comes from a place of I want Munster to do well. So I want to be honest, and I'm glad since it's come out, a few ex-players have been like, you know, that's great. We were all kind of thinking similar lines with the, you know, the recruitment side of things. So I'm not just the only bad guy.
I doubt you are. But look, your career has been an incredible journey, but on your journey goes a whole load of people. Your parents, your sisters, obviously Joanne, Alfie Lee, your son didn't get to see too much of it, but yeah. Did you enjoy the journey that you've given everybody else?
I loved it, yeah. And when I retired, Mick Kearney, who used to manage Ireland, we still in contact with him, he said, you're not the only one retiring. Your parents are, Joanna is, your sisters are, because they've been on, and my friends obviously who've come around the world and gone to games. And
but they got to go places that they would never have been if you weren't there.
Yeah, so I feel really lucky that they got to do that. And they've particularly my parents have made, and my wife Joanna, have made such good friends for life through rugby, and this beautiful game has given us so much outside of, you know, the pitch, really.
This is something you're proud of, isn't it?
Yeah, big time. Yeah, and something I didn't think I'd do. Like, early on, I just didn't see it as an option for me. Like, Keith Earls always slags me about being a late bloomer in terms of like talent wise, wasn't up to much when I was in school and even early days. But we got there in the end, and yeah, did something I didn't think I'd ever get to do, and gave people great days out.
You surely did. I can't wrap this up or let you go without asking about your dad. Obviously, Jerry was in a bad cycling accident. How was he doing?
He's great. He was in Tone Park last night having his few pints, and probably down in Ballybunion golfing today. So he gave us all and himself a big scare, and it was hit or miss for a while. And yeah, so impressive the resilience. Like, I'm saying it today, he didn't just lay in bed and get better. He had to work really hard on his rehab and, you know, walking properly again and everything. And he was really a source of inspiration for us watching him do it. You know what I mean? Because he's back now. He's, like I said, he's on the golf course 3, 4, 5 times a week, and thank God back to doing everything he was doing beforehand. So lucky escape.
A lucky escape, a very happy ending to a very sad situation. You've only retired today.
Yeah, it's gone great.
Obviously, this is a pre-record. Do you have a plan? Have you a plan? Or are you just going to... I met Pete last week, Peter Manny last week, and he kind of didn't know what he was doing 3 months later.
Yeah.
Have you any goals, plans?
I've goals and semi-plans, like half plans that... Like... Mick Kearney struck me up with Brian Crowley, my mentor for the last 10 years. And a few of us have done that, who has held my hand through all the off field stuff and kind of gotten me ready for this moment. But in saying that, you know, sports people die twice, don't they?
I don't
agree
with
that. They retire and then after.
I'm going to have that out with Brian O'Toole. I had it out with Tony McCoy. I don't agree with that. You retire and you're not dying. There is one hell of a difference.
Yeah, one hell of a difference.
You looked at your dad lying in the bed.
Yeah,
there
was a big difference. Perspective is completely different
huge,
after that.
Huge. No, I can't have that one.
You
it's
find yourself.
Me now.
Yeah, okay, fair. You do find what you want to do, but that, I think that'll take a couple of months or longer. So we've plans where we've... I said in the last time, we're moving to Derry. We bought a house up there, where Joanna's from, and really excited about that. It's going to be a great adventure for us as a young family. She's a huge family up there, so going up there.
To the bog site, watch Derry City.
Yeah, up to the Brandywell. Yeah. So really excited about that. And then a couple of options work-wise, but I'm gonna take a break first. I'll still... stay connected to the game with the media and the punditry and things to keep me busy for a while. But yeah, half a plan. But I think you need to.
You look like someone that's looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am. And like we were chatting before, I was ready. I knew you, and very hard to describe to people. And a few people are like, "You're fit
just
and healthy."
You.
Yeah, but you have a feeling, don't you? You just get a feeling, and you're like, "That's me. Thanks." And so grateful. Walk away really happy and proud.
It's great to walk before you're pushed.
Yeah. Oh, so you've nailed it there. That is exactly what I feared happening. And I got to be on the pitch with Munster and Ireland for my last game with each team, which was very important to me.
Well, you should be proud of yourself.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks a million.
Cheers, Ruby. Thank you.
Game on. Rugby.
Beautiful stuff there, Ruby. Beautiful, beautiful stuff.
He's a great talker, isn't he?
Absolutely. Immense. No, it was really, really insightful interview. And what a way to end this evening's show. That is all we have time for. Still nil all in Bilbao between Athletic Club and Arsenal. Marie will be back here in 2FM tomorrow from 6. Journalist Michael Moynihan will be in studio to discuss his new book on the future of the GAA, plus our Champions League coverage continues with Paul Corry, and we'll have the latest in the World Athletics Championships as they continue. Sabin is here in 2FM. Up next, it's the new music show with Beto da Silva for myself and Ruby and all of the Game On team. Have a great evening. Good luck. Bye bye.
This is 2FM.